Support for NPR podcasts comes from Progressive, serving customers since 1937. Service and rate information available at progressive.com or from local independent agents.
This is the WGBH Forum Network.
Just one request before we begin. If I can ask anybody who's carrying a cell phone to please silence it or turn it off. Just a word of introduction. When it comes to the Middle East, when it comes specifically to the Arab-Israeli conflict, there may be no more overworked phrase than peace process. It's invoked routinely by politicians, by diplomats, by journalists, sometimes with extraordinary fanfare, as for example when Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin shook hands on the South Lawn of the White House and signed the Oslo Accords in 1993. But for all the talk of peace process, there has never been lasting peace between Israel and its neighbors. There have been wars, and there have been skirmishes, and there have been border conflicts. There's been terrorism and counterterrorism. Today, with Hamas in control of the Gaza Strip, with Iranian influence spreading, with weak political leaders in Israel and the Palestinian Authority, to say nothing of a lame duck president in the United States, with the much-hyped roadmap seemingly leading nowhere, peace seems further away than ever. And yet, talk of a peace process seems to continue unabated. Just yesterday, for example, John McCain, back from his world travels, vowed that if he were elected president, he would, quote, devote every effort, including personal deep engagement and involvement in the Palestinian-Israeli peace process. And he said that peace in the Middle East is too important, quote, for us not to give it the highest priority. The question on the table is this relentless focus on the peace process truly the path to Arab-Israeli peace, or might it be counterproductive and an obstacle to peace? That's the subject that our speakers will introduce this evening, and let me introduce them to you now. Amy Doxer-Marcus is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She's a winner of the 1995 Pulitzer Prize for her reporting on the personal costs of cancer, physical, monetary, and emotional. She was based in Israel as the Journal's Middle East correspondent from 1991 to 1998, and she is the author of two books relating to the region. Her first was The View from Nebo, which dealt with archaeology in the Holy Land. Her new book is Jerusalem 1913, The Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. Daniel Pipes is one of the nation's best-known analysts of Islam in the Middle East. He's the proprietor of the influential website danielpipes.org, which for many people interested in these subjects is a must-read. He is the publisher of the Middle East Quarterly, a syndicated columnist, and the author of 12 books, including Militant Islam Reaches America and a collection of essays, miniatures. His reputation, I learned from his website today, is not limited to the United States or even to the West. In 2006, a video released by Al-Qaeda mentioned him by name and invited him to repent and enter into the light of Islam. Apparently, Dr. Pipes declined. Happily, he, like Amy Marcus, accepted our invitation to be here tonight. Amy Marcus will open the conversation with some prepared remarks, followed by Dr. Pipes. As always, at about 7:15, and I'll ask the speakers to keep an eye on the clock as well, we'll open the microphone that we have up front for questions from the audience. Please be aware this program is being recorded for the WGBH Forum Network. If you offer a comment or a question during the audience participation, please be sure to use the microphone so that you'll be heard. And also, please understand that by speaking, you're giving your consent to being recorded. And with that, please join me in welcoming our first speaker, Amy Doxer-Marcus.
First of all, thank you for the nice introduction. I appreciate it. And I'm very happy to be here with you tonight. I thought that actually before we got into the current situation that I would give you a page out of history and take us back to 1913. Now, some of you might say, why would 1913 be relevant to 2008? But what I argue is actually many of the problems that we see when we open up the daily newspaper or watch the news had their roots much further back in time even further back, I think, than the founding of the State of Israel in 1948. And when I was doing research for my book about Jerusalem during this very pivotal year of 1913, what I found was in the archives in Jerusalem was a set of letters that had been written in this year between Zionist officials. They were living all over. Some of them were based in Palestine, some were in Constantinople, some were in Germany. And one of the issues on their mind was, should we have peace talks with the Arabs? Should we try to resolve the situation in Palestine between ourselves? Now, this might seem quite preposterous because, after all, at that point, Palestine was part of the Ottoman Empire, and the Zionists weren't in control of Palestine, and actually neither were Arabs, technically speaking. But still, even at this early point in time, what these letters showed is that this conflict was already starting to emerge in a very limited but important way. So I thought that I'd give you a little bit of what I found in those documents, and then we could try to relate it to what we see now. So these peace talks that began was really started at the initiative of a group of Arabs who were working and living in Egypt. They had been observing the influx of Jews coming into Palestine. They had been observing the establishment of Jewish institutions in Palestine. And in many ways, these intellectuals and political people were very admiring of what the Zionists were accomplishing inside Palestine, to the point actually that they were quite frightened by it. They thought that the Zionists would ultimately be successful inside Palestine, perhaps even being able to establish Jewish control over Palestine. So they reached out to someone named Sammy Hochberg, who was in Constantinople editing a newspaper at the time. They wanted to have conversations, they said, with the Zionist officials. What Sammy spoke with his friend Victor Jacobson, who was one of the high-ranking Zionist officials in Constantinople at that time. And initially, Sammy Hochberg wanted Victor Jacobson to go to Egypt. After all, Sammy was an editor. He was identified with the Zionist movement, but he wasn't an official of it. And he thought it would be better if someone who was an official met with this group of Arabs in Egypt and started the conversation. But Victor, like sort of modern politicians today, didn't want to do that. What he liked about Sammy is that he could send Sammy off to Egypt and then disavow anything that Sammy did if he didn't like what the outcome was, which I thought was a pretty interesting and very shrewd political strategy. So that's what happened. Sammy went off to Cairo, and he met with a group of leaders. He went from place to place, and he talked with them, and he ate with them. And he came back, and he wrote a very remarkable report, a copy of which is in the archives in Jerusalem, called The Arab Movement. In this report, he described the talks that he had had and what he had learned. And what he talked about was the emergence of Arab nationalism. And his conclusion was that there was a need for the Zionists to address this movement and to somehow deal with it. The Arab nationalists, he wrote in his report, said that they looked around at the situation that was happening in the Ottoman Empire, and they were extremely pragmatic about what they were seeing. They felt that the Ottoman Empire was weak, and that a strong nationalist movement that was willing to take up arms against the Ottoman Empire might be able to get their way. And Sammy found that idea extremely dangerous in a way, and he thought that if the Zionists wanted to have some kind of foothold in Palestine, that they really ought to talk to the Arab leaders before things got to the issue of armed conflict. There was a conference in Paris in June of 1913 in which the Arab leaders came from all over the Ottoman Empire. They met to discuss a range of topics. Their primary focus at that time was really the role of Arabs inside the empire. They wanted more control over their own affairs. They wanted more autonomy. They wanted to be able to speak their language in the schools. That was the primary topic that they were discussing at that meeting. But they were also going to talk about the Palestine conflict and the tensions between Zionists and Arabs inside Palestine. And Sammy, again, urged Victor Jacobson to go to Paris and to try to make contact with some of the leaders and have discussions. And once again, Victor Jacobson said, "I don't think so. You go instead." And he gave him a nice traveling budget, and he told Sammy to take everyone out to dinner on the Zionist movement, which he did. They went out to dinner and they talked, and it's hard to know if it was Sammy taking everyone out to dinner or what, but the Ottomans, the officials in Constantinople, got nervous. They were nervous about the idea of Arab nationalists and Zionists joining forces together. That was actually, I mean, I know it might sound almost humorous in light of what's happened in the modern era, but you know, that was what they were fearful of, is that they would join together, join forces, and then the Ottomans would really be in trouble inside Palestine if they could make common cause together. So the Ottomans came and cut a separate deal with the Arab nationalists. And that was sort of the end of the conversation at that point. But Sammy didn't give up. And in fact, by October of 1913, Victor Jacobson had been persuaded by events, by the reports, by what he was reading, and by what he was thinking, that actually reaching some kind of entente with the Arabs over the issue of Palestine might be critical. And in the beginning of 1914, he tried to organize some kind of meeting. Now, he didn't exactly call it peace talks. I think that's more of a modern sort of word. But he did want to have a conversation. He did want to bring the leaders together. He did want to, you know, get talks started. Now, it probably won't surprise you, but the peace talks fell apart. And here's what happened. The Zionists actually couldn't agree on who they should send to represent them. They were worried that if they sent very high-ranking people, and that if the Arab side didn't reciprocate by sending comparable high-ranking officials, then it would be insulting and also counterproductive, because they wouldn't be able to come to any kind of agreements of any kind, because the people who would be coming wouldn't have any kind of official power. On the Arab side, they also couldn't decide how to go about it, because they set a number of preconditions that were almost impossible for the Zionists to meet. For instance, they said that they did not want to meet with any Zionist official who had been involved in any way, shape, or form with land purchases for Jewish settlements inside Palestine. Well, of course, the Zionist movement, the Zionist officials, that was one of the main things that they were doing. And so by saying that, you virtually ruled out anyone who had any power in the Zionist movement. So it was sort of a non-starter. The other thing that they said when they were sort of negotiating on who would go, they said to the Zionist officials, "You know what? Before we decide whether we really want to go, and before we decide actually who we should send, we'd like you to lay out your aims. What are your goals inside Palestine? If we agree that your goals are something that we can agree with, then we'll come." Well, once all of this started to go, the letters between Victor Jacobson and Arthur Rubin and Sammy Hochberg and some of the Zionist officials and interested parties here, it started to change sort of the tune. Victor Jacobson, who had actually been very excited about the prospect of peace talks, now wondered if it might make things worse if they met. They sent letters around debating it back and forth. Arthur Rubin, who was Victor Jacobson's counterpart inside Palestine, said that essentially what the Arabs wanted was for the Zionists to assimilate themselves into Palestine and into the larger Middle East. They didn't want the Zionists to set up schools where the children would be learning Hebrew. Rather, they wanted schools where they would all learn Arabic together, because that was the main language of the region. And what they worried about was, since the Zionist program at that time was very focused on establishing not only a physical presence inside Palestine, but also a cultural and political identity, they worried that they would end up in a situation where they would go and talk, and the only thing they could talk about would be, let's kind of talk about how we need to reach an agreement, but not actually reach one. And in fact, you know, one of the people in the Zionists in the letter said, the Arabs were and remain our natural opponents, and it's going to be very difficult for us to reach an agreement when what we want to do, what they want from us is not something we can give, and they can't compromise on what they want from us. At the same time that this kind of these letters were going back and forth, the Arabs also started backing off from the idea that having talks would be fruitful. One of the leaders who had met with Sammy Hochberg in 1913 and sort of started down the road of thinking that it was time to talk actually said in some of his own documents that if it was going to be impossible for the two sides to reach an agreement, then there was going to be a war. And perhaps it was time to start preparing with that idea in mind. And what happened in the end was that World War I broke out. And so the meeting never got off the ground, but they also didn't even end up having tension over not meeting because nobody could travel once the war started and things just faded and the war, you know, took over. But when I read these letters, I found it kind of remarkable how many echoes there were. I mean, unlike in our modern era where there's a superpower that kind of brokers talks and gets involved in the talks and bringing the sides together, the two sides found one another on their own. The leaders were looking for kind of academic or non-political types that they could use as front men so that they could have a political fig leaf and not have to go out on a limb too much with their constituents before anything was decided, which is another tactic that you see used. But I also wanted to raise the interesting issue that both sides were concerned that talking without any kind of purpose, talking when you know that you really can't get to an agreement, can be dangerous. They never really got to resolve, well, what would be the alternative to that? If you're not talking, but you don't want to have an armed conflict, is there a third way? You know, I sometimes wonder whether if the war hadn't broken out, if the Ottomans had been able to sort of pursue more their notion of an Ottoman identity that could encompass all ethnic groups and all religious groups, that maybe there would have been a third way. But like in our modern era, we're not always in control of what happens, and sometimes even good intentions get swept away by events, wars, things that happen where the parties that are living in the region aren't able even to change their own destiny. So I think I'll end my remarks there, and I hope you enjoyed the little peek into history. So thank you.
Amy, thank you very much. Let me just mention, ladies and gentlemen, that after the program is finished, both of our speakers will be signing copies of their books. Their books are for sale in the back of the room, and they'll be up front at these, well, one round and one not round table, autographing them for those who are interested. Now we'll hear from Daniel Pipes.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm honored to be part of the Ford Hall Forum. I've heard many of the talks out of this forum, delighted to be part of it myself, and especially in this historic site of the Old South Meeting House. Our topic this evening are negotiations between the Arabs and the Israelis. Ms. Marcus gave a fascinating glimpse of something nearly a century ago, something that presumably none of you know about. I certainly didn't. What I'd like to do is bring it up to the present and directly answer the question of this evening's discussion. Is it a peace process or a war process that's taking place between the Arabs and the Israelis? Peace process is the term of art. You heard just yesterday John McCain endorsed the peace process. I believe it's a war process, by which I mean that rather than leading to resolution, harmony, lack of conflict, the negotiations specifically of the last 15 years since the Oslo Agreement of September 1993 have increased the hostility, the violence, the deaths. It's worth thinking back those 15 years to the 13th of September 1993, a glorious late summer day on the White House lawn, when Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister of Israel, and Yasser Arafat, the chairman of the PLO, met on the White House lawn and shook hands. You may recall that the shaking hands was a picture unto itself that was symbolic of the possibilities of negotiations. It's a bit embarrassing to recall, actually, but President Clinton, who presided over that event, called it a great occasion in history. Yasser Arafat said that it was a historic event, inaugurating a new epoch. Shimon Peres, who was foreign minister of Israel, discerned in it the outline of peace in the Middle East. It was a brilliant solution, everyone said, whereby each side achieved what it most wanted: dignity and autonomy for the Palestinians, recognition and security for the Israelis. But in reality, it brought quite the reverse. To the Palestinians, it brought poverty. It brought corruption. It brought suicide factories, a cult of death, 3,500 dead, and a radicalization of the political arena. There's no question the Palestinians were better off in 1993 than when these talks ended in 2000. To the Israelis, it brought suffering as well. Some 1,100 murders, 6,000 serious injuries, economic decline, diplomatic isolation. Today, the word Oslo, the concept Oslo, not the city, is mud for both sides. All agree that it was not a new epoch, or at least not a good new epoch. There's great disagreement over what went wrong. And the conventional interpretation is that what went wrong were the details. Yasser Arafat was a malign personality. Too much attention was paid to the elites and not enough to the masses. It was something minor. My disagreement is, or my assessment is more profound, that the Oslo agreements of 1993 were premised on the belief that when Yasser Arafat wrote a letter on the 9th of September 1993 to President Clinton, in which he said, quote, "the PLO recognizes the right of the State of Israel to exist in peace and security," unquote, he meant it. He meant it, and he meant it for the duration. In fact, he didn't mean it, and it was a deceit. In fact, there was no closing down of the existential question of Israel. In other words, the Oslo Accords appeared to change the issue from whether Israel should exist or not, which the Palestinians hitherto had said no, to a question of borders, sanctities, natural resources, armaments, residential patterns of living. It appeared that the existential question had been closed, but in fact, it had not been. And the Israelis did their part to try and end the conflict by making concessions, by being flexible, being restrained, being generous, giving the Palestinians land, money, arms, recognition. But it didn't work because the Palestinians used the money to build an arsenal. They saw the concessions as those made by demoralized and weakened Israel, and their hostility was aroused. And if this handshake between Rabin and Arafat was the symbol of 1993, the symbol of the year 2000, when the talks came to an end, were the two bloodied hands of a young Palestinian who just lynched two Israelis when they took a wrong turn, and he showed his bloodied hands to the international media. So from shaking of hands to showing bloody hands is what the Oslo process wrought. The concessions reduced Palestinian awe of Israeli might, made Israel more vulnerable, incited irredentist dreams, led to growing anger and ambition, and leaves us in the situation we are today. Not that much has happened to change things since 2000. The result has been a radicalized and mobilized Palestinian body politic that hopes, in a way it did not in 1993, that it can, that believes it can, eliminate the Israeli state. And one can see this in words, in political rhetoric, the media, school materials, posters, mosque sermons, and one can also see it in pictures, such as maps and videos made by suicide bombers, and one can see it in actions, in the murders and the attempted murders of Israelis. The muted Palestinian mood of 1993 was transformed into the enraged ambition of 2000. What war achieved for Israel during a 45-year period from 1948 to 1993, diplomacy between 1993 and 2000 undid and remains undid. Post-Oslo, since 2000, one has 8 lost years. There's a disillusion with negotiation, but nothing has replaced them. The Israelis have tried other things, like unilateral withdrawals from Lebanon in 2000 and Gaza in 2005. Their attempts at Palestinian democracy, foreign aid is now a very major factor, but none of it has led to a basic change. Where next? What to do about it? If Oslo was a failure, if the peace process was in fact a war process, what can one do that would work better? I think it's important to acknowledge the faulty presumptions that underlay Oslo, that the Palestinians had accepted Israel and instead try and achieve what Oslo had assumed. We must resolve not to make the same mistakes. We must make popular Palestinian acceptance of Israel's existence the primary goal. The body politic of the Palestinians need to accept that. We must work for what was hitherto assumed. Polls, votes, and other data suggests that some 20% of Palestinians accept Israel. It's not none, but 20%. A minority that is essentially voiceless, that has no power. The goal must be to increase that number of Palestinians who are willing to live side by side with Israel, who are not aspiring to eliminate Israel, from 20% to, say, 60%, a nice solid majority. That means changing 40% of the Palestinians' views, getting them to move from where they are now, which is dreaming of, desiring, sacrificing for the elimination of Israel, and instead accepting Israel, willing to work with it in some ways, like those 1913 Arabs. Diplomacy can work only when there is an acceptance by the Palestinians of Israel, when they have given up their anti-Zionist dreams. Diplomacy doesn't work unless that happens. And I've mentioned Oslo, but Oslo is just the first. I can give you a long list of subsequent efforts that have also failed. The Geneva Accords, the Quartet, the Roadmap, the Mitchell Report, the Tenet Understandings, the Abdullah Plan, the Benchmarks for Peace, the Zinni, Wolfensohn, Ward, Dayton, and Jones missions, all of them have failed. What this means is pressuring the Palestinians to abandon their goal of extermination. It means doing what we can, our government and other institutions doing what they can, to convince the Palestinians that their dream of eliminating Israel is futile, will not succeed, is a failed dream. And this will not be a pleasant process. I wish that the Oslo and other attempts at compromise had succeeded. It would be nice to finesse war, but there is a war underway, a war in which the Palestinians seek to eliminate Israel and the Israelis seek to win the acceptance of the Jewish state. It's a war. It's a war that's been going on in some sense since 1913, or I'd even date it to 1911, certainly since 1948 with the creation of the Israeli state. It's a war that has been in some sense very static. Those terms since 1948, accept Israel or eliminate Israel, have been the terms. And I don't see the compromise as possible, and I submit to you that the war process that took place in the 1990s endorses, confirms my skepticism. That in fact, first the Palestinians must come to accept Israel. And then, once that happens, something like the Oslo process might work. To put it a little differently, Yitzhak Rabin, who was the originator of the Oslo process, repeated on many occasions the following phrase: you don't make peace with your friends, you make peace with your enemies. I disagree. I believe it should read differently. You don't make peace with your friends, you make peace with your former enemies. You can't make peace with an enemy who wants to undo you, exterminate you. You can't make peace with such an enemy. Only when that enemy has given up and is a former enemy can you have negotiations, can you have resolution. For now, I would say, with the Palestinians, each of us has to make up his or her mind, whose side are you on? Are you on the Palestinian side and you seek the elimination of Israel? Or are you on the Israeli side and you seek the acceptance of Israel? It has been the permanent policy of the United States and all other Western governments to seek the acceptance of Israel. It is mine as well. If that is the case, then the logical conclusion from that is to put pressure on the Palestinians to reach that conclusion. And that means many things. It means, for example, no financial aid to the Palestinians. We and other Western states back in November pledged $7.3 billion to the Palestinians, the highest per capita amount going to anyone in foreign aid in the world. There should be no arms or training. There should be no diplomacy. There should be no final status speculations about what the Palestinians will end up with. No recognition of a state and no quick fixes. There is a war that needs to be resolved. We want the Israelis to win that war. We want the Palestinians to accept Israel. And let me conclude by noting that were the Palestinians to reach this conclusion, it would be good not just for Israel, but also for them. For Israel, obviously, it would be good. The Israelis would no longer be under siege from terrorism, from missiles, from potentially weapons of mass destruction, conventional armaments, and so forth. It's what the Israelis dream of, to be a normal Western state that doesn't have to assert its defense every day. Obviously, it's to Israel's benefit for the Palestinians to accept it. But it's also, ironically, to the Palestinians' benefit, because while Israel is a functioning modern state with great achievements to its credit, the Palestinians are a broken society, a broken polity, a broken culture, and a broken economy. It's not functioning. Institutions are not. There's poverty, there's despotism, there's backwardness. They will only leave that unhappy condition once they stop focusing on the foul, irredentist dream of eliminating their neighbor. Only when they stop, when that 40% or more changes its mind, will they be able to function on their own polity, economy, society, and culture. And so, ironically, it is very much in the Palestinians' interest to be liberated from this goal of destroying the enemy. It is in their interest, it's in the Israelis' interest, and it's in our interest. So the goal must be, our goal, American goal, as well as our allies and the Israelis, whichever Arabs are willing to join with us, is to convince the Palestinians to give up the goal of eliminating Israel, to accept Israel, and to move on. Thank you.
In just a moment, we'll begin the questions and comments from the audience portion of the program. I would invite those of you who are interested to come to the microphone that's up here in front of the middle aisle. Those of you in the balcony, to walk down and come up to the microphone as well. And let me just remind you as well, knowing that this is something of a sometimes volatile subject, that the Ford Hall Forum's commitment and purpose, the reason that it exists, is to promote dialogue and to promote free expression for opinions across the spectrum. Let me invoke the moderator's privilege by beginning with my own question for our two speakers. Amy Marcus, in your book, Jerusalem 19, there's a passage that you quote from Arthur Rupin, who was the head of the Zionist office in Palestine during the late Ottoman period, which it seems to me, in a way, is sort of a foreshadowing of some of the message that Daniel Pipes just articulated. You write that Rupin wrote, quote over here. The Zionists, here's the paragraph in the book. The Zionists could argue until they were breathless about the benefits of their economic and social plans, but this would not, and here's the quote from Rupin, this would not move the Arabs to relinquish what they believe to be their power over Palestine to the Jews or to share it with the Jews, so long as they are the overwhelming majority here, Rupin wrote. The Zionists would achieve nothing by asking the Arabs for concessions, or making concessions to the Arabs for that matter. Rather, they had to create a situation in which accepting the Jewish presence in Palestine was not a choice, but rather a question of coming to terms with reality. It strikes me that that's a sort of, as it were, Pipesian message, and I wonder if you think that that's a right reading of it, and to what extent that view that Rupin expressed so long ago is indeed relevant in the 21st century.
So an incredible writer, and he lived a long life, and he wrote a lot. His views evolved over time. In his diaries and in his letters, he was constantly questioning himself. So he definitely, you know, he definitely said that, and that was the, and he had that thinking. Later on, he also wrestled with, well, we're the victors. You know, we won our state, and so how can we be, you know, non-chauvinistic in the way we treat the people who weren't the victors? And so his thinking evolved, and one of the things that he ended up saying, I think it was around 1938, was that he wanted both sides to lower their kind of ideological, you know, strength, in the sense that he wanted both sides to be much more pragmatic in lowering their expectations, lowering what they wanted. So I think if he was here today, he might say, you know, to Hamas, you're not going to be able to eliminate the state of Israel. It's not going to be possible. So you ought to lower your rhetoric and come to terms with that. And to the Israelis, he would say, you know, how can we support people and help create, you know, a constituency, a broader constituency on the side of the Palestinians who would work with us. I mean, he was, so I find him to be very pragmatic and not so ideological, and changing of his opinions a lot.
Daniel Pipes, thoughts on thoughts on that?
The ideas I have are actually quite traditional. I could put it in the sense that the Israeli policy from 1948 till 1993, till Oslo, was the policy of deterrence, the policy of being tough, of making life unpleasant for anyone who attacked Israel, and most importantly, seeking victory. Somewhat analogous to the US-Soviet, we couldn't win over the Soviets, they had to lose, and then we won. We couldn't defeat them. We couldn't decide on our own in 1989 that, you know, we've had enough of this conflict, time to end it. It required the Soviets to implode. Well, likewise, the Israelis followed a policy that required the Arabs to give up. But in 1993, they said to themselves, we've got enough of this. We, you know, deterrence is expensive, it's boring, it's passive. We can't do it ourselves. Let's take steps that allow us to do it ourselves. Let's seek resolution, not victory, but resolution. Let's give our enemies something so that they will leave us in peace. Let's give them land and money and arms and recognition and hope that by having a nice apartment and a late model car, they will be busy with their daily lives and leave us alone. Well, if that first policy has a name, deterrence, the second policy has a name too, and it's called appeasement, and it doesn't work. And so all I think the Israelis should do is go back to deterrence, go back to victory. And in some sense, go back to the traditional thinking that returns to the 19-teens. There's a famous article by Jabotinsky in 1923 called The Iron Wall. This is nothing new. It's simply, in some sense, repeating the verities of Zionism in a new era.
Thank you both. Let's turn this over to our questioners. There are quite a number of people lining up. Let me just ask you, please, to feel free to ask a question or to make a comment, but anything other than to make a speech. Sir, please begin.
Among all possibilities, and as we look to the future on what could happen, what might happen, is there any chance that an all-out civil war among the Palestinians will finally settle this, and that a force would emerge that really is interested in peace, that the bad guys will be put down ultimately, an all-out civil war, that they finally settle this?
I don't think an all-out civil war will settle it, in that the civil war that does exist already is over tactics and personnel and philosophy rather than over goals. That is to say, Fatah, or the PLO on the one hand, and Hamas on the other hand, entirely agree on the goal of eliminating Israel. They disagree on how to do it, and who should do it, and the spirit in which you do it. So were one side to win, and more likely that would be Hamas, I don't see any fundamental change. There's that 80% dominates, the 20% has no voice. It would take something far more profound to lead to a real shift.
And do you want to jump in?
Well, I also, though, I don't think that most Israelis would wish for a civil war. I don't think that's going to be even positive for Israel if that happens. I mean, the last thing you want is to have a neighbor who cuts sort of across, you know, you're sharing a lot of common, you know, sort of roads and you're intersecting with to disintegrate before your eyes. I actually think it's in Israel's political interest to try to, you know, bolster the middle ground. I don't think it's such a hard and fast choice between, elimination and, you know, or acceptance. I mean, I'm looking for more like, Cold War, like they have, Cold Peace, let's say, Cold Peace like they have with Egypt. I think that would be a victory too.
Sir.
Well, the discussion tonight has been as one-sided as American foreign policy in the Middle East. There's not a war going on there, there's an occupation going on there. And under the Geneva Conventions, it's illegal for an occupied people to be negotiating with their occupiers. So wouldn't the best solution to the problem be for the United States to take an even-handed policy position in the Middle East and treat Israel the same way it treats Iraq, which is to say to assemble a coalition of the willing and drive Israel out of the illegally occupied territories, to slap sanctions on Israel until it eliminates its vast arsenal of weapons of mass destruction and it can be readmitted into the community of nations as a peaceful, law-abiding citizen?
You're advocating the United States go to war with Israel.
Yeah, you're a great advocate of war.
We don't generally go to war with our allies, and I would suggest that's not a good idea in this case.
A new set of allies.
Excuse me, you spoke, now I speak. I would suggest it's not a good idea to go to war with our allies and in general, and it's specifically not a good idea in this case.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's it. Great.
My mic? Oh, sorry. Okay.
The United States gives Israel $10 million a day. It's over $3 billion a year in armaments to kill what you call Palestinians, which are Christians, Muslims, and any Jewish Palestinian. They are a Semitic people. They are an assortment of people who've resided in that area for millennium. My question is, do you consider targeted assassination, home demolition, checkpoints, curfews, Jewish-only roads, do you consider the genocide, the ongoing genocide, the wall that's being built with American money, the 9 meter tall cement wall that is not even being built on the 67 border? Do you consider the targeted assassination of children in the head, the heart, and the genitals? Do you consider the border crossings that are preventing food and medicine from going through?
Okay,
Do you consider the ongoing genocide a part of negotiations? Do you consider that Israel, with the fifth largest army in the world, against a civilian population, do you consider that negotiations?
Okay, they've got the question. Let's have the speakers offer an answer.
You forgot to ask me if I beat my wife. I can't answer your question. Your question is a loaded question. Full of misfacts, misstatements, inaccuracies, exaggerations. I can't answer it. If you ask a reasonable question, one could answer it. But okay.
Okay, madam. There are people waiting behind. Next, please.
It's a tough act to follow. I have two quick questions. One for Amy, one for Daniel. First of all, Amy, you suggested that 1913 was the pivotal year that began a lot of the animosities between Arabs and Jews in pre-state Palestine. Aren't you omitting a vast body of solid scholarship from Moshe Gil, who wrote about Palestine in the medieval period, to Joseph Schacht, to Eliezer Tauber, who wrote about early Arab nationalist movements, which essentially, and also a very new book by Andrew Boston called The Legacy of Islamic Antisemitism, which for the first time is really exploring the almost congenital hatred of Jews as a dhimmi, or second-class people, beginning in the year 638 with the Arab conquests. I'd like you to address that. And my next question is for Daniel. In October of 1939, October, a year after the Germans marched into Poland, can you conceive of a victory tour for Neville Chamberlain? I'm asking this question because tomorrow at Tufts University, General Zinni and one of the negotiators for the Oslo process under President Clinton will be acclaimed as experts on the Middle East. The notion that these people are somehow victorious in the negotiations boggles my mind, at least. How do you explain the acclaim that these people have received in spite of their abject failure?
All right, should we take them one at a time? Amy, the...
So I think what I would say to that is that when you select a year to focus on, you know, of course, there's always other years that you could choose and marshal your evidence for. What I was trying to do in my book was not to say there wasn't anything prior to 1913. In fact, I start my book earlier with Herzl's visit to Jerusalem, so I even predate my own book. But what I was trying to do is, I was a reporter in the Middle East. I covered Israel and the Palestinians from 1991 to 1998. And as I ran from problem to problem and covering things, I kept asking myself, you know, was it always like this? How did things get so bad? Was there a moment in time when things might have gone in a different direction? And so when I started unraveling, what I was looking for was a period or a year in which there was enough going on, where there was enough of a sense of growing national identity, where there was enough sense of, wow, you know what? We've been sharing this particular city, but we may end up having to part ways, emerging. And I found myself really engaged by that and trying to go through the historical record, to read memoirs, which I did, to go in the archives, to read letters that Muslims and Christians and Jews and people that call themselves Zionists and people that call themselves, some call themselves Palestinians even then, people who call themselves Arabs, Ottomans, you know, how did the unraveling of their shared space happen? Were they upset about it? Were they happy about it? Did they want to stop it? So I wasn't trying so much to say that this is the only answer. I think I was trying to put forward a really interesting story about unique individuals who were able, even in 1913, to see this is going to get really, really messy really soon, and to try to let each of them, through their own words and through documents, describe what life was like for them at a particular moment of time in a beautiful city that people today still fight over and love.
Before Daniel tackles the second question, Amy, let me just follow up your answer to that first question with one other passage that I was struck by in the book. You mentioned that you begin the book even before 1913. You talk about Theodor Herzl's one and only visit to Palestine in 1898. And you write near the start of the book, even before Herzl's visit, these Arab families, and you talk about some of the renowned Jerusalem Arab families, the Husseinis, the Khalidis, and several mm-hmm. others, even before Herzl's visit, meaning 19th century, these Arab families had been urging the Sultan to start restricting Jewish immigration to Palestine. In 1891, 500 representatives of the leading Arab families signed a petition asking the Sultan to stop Jews from purchasing land there. And I was, what struck me about it was the rejectionist note that is so often articulated today. Only then it had nothing to do with military issues or occupation or force of arms. It was to prevent even willing buyers and willing sellers from mm-hmm. making a land transaction. And I wonder to what extent, as you did some of the research on what was taking place back in the Ottoman era, you found that sort of rejectionist mentality an obstacle that wouldn't go away no matter how much time endured.
You know, there were different factions. The elites, you know, they had a vested interest in keeping the status quo as it was. Those families that signed the petition were among the wealthiest inside Palestine. They were the ones who always got the good jobs, and then they were able to pass those jobs on to their sons.
And so I think that it wasn't so much political or philosophical, but actually economic, that they were trying to preserve their power, and that still continued even as more land was bought and established. What was also interesting to me is that when the Young Turks came to power and actually allowed for elections, Jews were a majority inside Jerusalem in 1908, but found actually that they were politically powerless because most of them hadn't taken Ottoman citizenship and then couldn't vote in the elections. They tried to make alliances. They tried to throw their political weight behind a Muslim candidate that might represent their views, and found that they weren't able to do so. And this started some of the shift in their thinking, too, about whether their strategies should shift from, you know, economic autonomy, which is what they were focusing on, to political autonomy. So, I do see that there were a number of different interests that were converging among the elites primarily, but there was a lot going on as the situation evolved and the political power started to shift.
Daniel Pipes, the second question about who qualifies as an expert.
Great question, Hillel. Why do the implementers of the war process get celebrated? Because they offer hope. They offer hope of avoiding war, of finding some way around it. It's a bit analogous to why socialists are esteemed, because socialism is a hope that doesn't die. Why does Barack Obama's office someplace have a picture of Che Guevara on the wall? Because for some people he represents hope. And what I'm offering is not hope in the idealist sense. I'm offering a tough road to hoe and saying there's a war and it's got to be won. It's less pleasant, I acknowledge, than saying, look, be clever, have some really bright people figure out compromises, and you can avoid war. Lovely idea. It'll always trump realism, but it'll always fail. And so there's this dynamic between the appeal of the ideal and its failure. And what we're seeing is an ideal that lasts and lasts and lasts. But I'm optimistic that one of these days, after this dream of finessing war, of resolution without victory, shows itself to be a failure time and time and time again, that eventually there will be an acknowledgement that, well, you know, there is a war and it has to be won. In the meantime, I make the arguments hoping that eventually these will stick.
Next question, please.
He had a very difficult time convincing his colleagues that he had taken the right route. If you go back to September, October of 1993 and look at the reactions within Fatah, within the PLO, you'll see great consternation as to what Arafat did. But specifically to answer your question, there's a huge body of evidence that he spoke one way, for example, when he was receiving the Nobel Prize in December of 1993, and more broadly speaking to Western audiences and Western figures, individuals, leaders, and he spoke a very different way when he spoke in Arabic and he spoke to Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims. The contrast was there year after year, and I actually did a study in 1995 that looked at it quantitatively and looked at various metrics and measures and showed how to the one audience he said one thing and to the other the other. That to me spells deceit.
Thank you.
Next, please.
For Dr. Pipes, to what extent is this a religious and to what extent a national conflict? Was Arafat an apostate? Do the 40% that you wish, that we all hope, of the Palestinians switching to the other side, can that be accomplished without a radical reform of Islam, which many people think that the existence of a non-Muslim state in the region, whether it be a Jewish Israel or hopefully a Christian Southern Sudan, is a theological catastrophe to the beliefs of Islam, which has Jews and Christians defined as dhimmi subjugated tributaries religiously?
I'd make two points. Good question, Chuck. One is that there is an Islamic imperative that when a territory has become part of Dar al-Islam, has come under control of Muslims, that it must always, permanently, forever be under Muslim control. And should it fall from Muslim control, then Muslims must regain it. That is an Islamic imperative. It's part of jihad, thimitude, and so forth. But at the same time, it's worth noting that there are many countries that were once partially or wholly under Muslim control, starting with Portugal and Spain and Italy and Greece, former Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, Romania, Cyprus, India, many, many countries that were predominantly under Muslim control are not now. And although, say, a bin Laden might dream of reconquest of Spain, it's actually not terribly operational. So reality does intrude, and there are many countries which escape that Islamic imperative, and Israel could be one of them. Second point would be that in the course of this century of anti-Zionism, it has had four different political bases. The main one until 1945 was pan-Syrian nationalism, seeing the territory that Israel controls as southern Syria. Syria not in the sense of the small state that exists today, but the larger, what called in English, Greater Syria, Suria al-Kubra, which is Israel, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, it can be parts of Turkey, it can be parts of Iraq, some people would even include Cyprus. Anyway, a grand eastern Mediterranean state called Syria. And until 1945, that was the dominant approach. Indeed, I wrote a book called Greater Syria, documenting that. The second era was 1945 to 1967, which was the era of pan-Arab nationalism, of which Gamal Abdel Nasser was the leading figure. The states will combine under Egyptian or other leadership and form one grand Arab state from Morocco to Iraq. The third era was Palestinian nationalism. Yasser Arafat was the symbol of that, in which the Palestinians themselves would create a Palestinian state, a Palestinian flag, Palestinian membership in the United Nations, and take the place of Israel. The fourth and current era, which I date to about a decade ago, is the Islamist era, where Hamas is growing in strength and pretty clearly is the dominant factor today. Who knows what the fifth might be? In other words, there is a kernel of anti-Zionism that's taken very different expressions over the course of just one century and is still potentially evolving. So I don't see it as such as necessarily Islamist or Islamic, because it wasn't in the past and need not be in the future.
Can I just follow up on that with Amy? Did you find, looking back at the Ottoman period, that there was a religious element to the tensions and to the conflict, or was it simply over the political and nationalist issues that you were talking about before?
No, there was a religious element to it, because religious identity also became sort of part of your national identity. One of the things that used to sort of make me think, well, could this have been an alternative way, is the fact that the Young Turks, when they first came to power in 1908, started down a path of almost similar to what we have in the United States, that is, let us create an Ottoman identity, one that you, even if you privately worship someplace, you identify yourself as a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim, no matter what school you choose to send your children to, no matter what newspapers you want to read at your morning table, and even if all your friends belong to one group or the other, there might be something that you have in common, something that goes above your private, ethnic, religious, social identity that you can call your national identity, meaning Ottomanism. And they started down that road and stopped and actually veered off to becoming very nationalistic themselves, saying you have to be a Turk and you can't speak any other language except Turkish. And it got even more intensified by World War I. And when I spoke with, scholars of that period, and I have to tell you that many Palestinians and many Israelis, when you speak with them today, are very nostalgic about the Ottoman era. I found that almost, kind of sweet and charming, but, they'll talk about, oh, the Ottoman era, and, my father was an Ottoman, and, those were the good old days. And, of course, that's, forgetting what all the tensions that existed then too. But I think what does appeal to people was this notion that in addition to your religious identity, you could create an Ottoman identity. And I always feel badly that they never got really to test that experiment because they chose poorly, you know, they chose the losing side, and you know, everything fell apart for them. And it would have been an interesting experiment to see if they could come up with an identity that wasn't purely religious and was national, but everyone subsumed under that.
Yes, sir. Next question, please.
On November 18th of 2007, the foreign minister of Israel, Livni, and speaking about that, the creation of a future Palestinian state, spoke of it as a comprehensive national solution for Palestinians, including those in the occupied territories and the Arabs living within Israel itself. Some of the Arabs in Israel felt really threatened by the thought of a future expulsion, having lived there all their lives. But is this a step that is really seriously considered by the government of Israel, expelling the Israeli Arabs?
The thoughts that sometimes occur to Israelis, such as Foreign Minister Livni, Prime Minister Sharon before her, do not entail forcing Palestinians out, or what's called transfer. It rather entails changing the boundaries so that, for example, Palestinians living in Jerusalem or in what's called the Triangle in the Galilee or in other places would find themselves in the West Bank. In other words, it's saying the boundaries of 1949 are not sacrosanct. And whereas Maale Adonim, which is a almost entirely Jewish town outside of Jerusalem, should be in Israel, Om El-Fah in the southern Galilee shouldn't be in Israel. So it's musings along those lines. Nothing has come of them so far. And what has been so interesting has been the Palestinian reaction, particularly in Jerusalem and in the Triangle. When these ideas are bruited about, as you suggested, there's great nervousness. And it's a very interesting nervousness because on the one hand, and increasingly, Israeli Arabs are anti-Israel, are rejecting the Jewish nature of the Israeli state. On the other hand, they're increasingly appreciating the benefits of being Israeli as opposed to being in the PA, in the Palestinian Authority, be it economic benefits, rule of law benefits, insurance, medical insurance benefits, and pension benefits, and the like. So, while they increasingly do not want to be part of a Jewish state, they're increasingly eager to live in the Jewish state. And it's creating tensions that have so far had no particular political consequences, but could be very important. Should someday there be a resolution, should there someday be real negotiations along the lines I hope there will be, and then the horse trading begins, including geographic horse trading. And I suspect that the Arabs of Israel will say, no. Judging by the reactions today, they'll say, we want to stay here. We care for our health insurance more than we care for our nationalistic dreams. Very interesting.
Two-part question. I was wondering, what do you think will be the ultimate resolution, either a two-part state, one Gaza Strip and one West Bank, or a single state? And then also, I was wondering, considering the fact that many Palestinians have Jordanian passports, why doesn't Jordan take more of an interest in action in the Palestinian problem and maybe taking them out of the Israel conflict and incorporating them into Jordan life?
I wrote an article called Two Palestines, Anyone? If you love Palestine, you should be really happy because now you got two of them, one in Gaza and one in the West Bank. There is a real difference between the two. Gaza has historically been more tied to Egypt. Listen to the Arabic spoken in Gaza, and it is the Arabic of the Sinai Peninsula. It is the Arabic of Egypt. Look at the commercial ties. Look at the family ties. They are more to Egypt than to the Northeast. And I suspect the division that has taken place might well be a lasting one. As for Jordan, the Jordanians were very involved from 1948 until 1988. At which time King Hussein renounced Jordanian claims to the West Bank. And while there are certainly plenty of Jordanians who would love to get back in, the consensus has been that it was too painful, too messy, too problematic, and they're best off sitting on the sidelines and letting the Palestinians and others deal with the West Bank. That could change.
My question is primarily for Mr. Pipes, but I'd also like to hear what Ms. Marcus has to say. You presented us with a pretty stark either-or. Either we should support the Israeli state or we shouldn't. It seems that many Palestinians have chosen not to, or you know, they're for the destruction of the Israeli state. And you've suggested that what the allies of Israel need to do is to put pressure on them in order to change their minds. I wonder if you could, this is a very big question, but provide other reasons other than pragmatic ones, namely moral or rational ones, other than, for example, it may help the Palestinian state economically to accept the state of Israel. What I'm looking for is more moral justification, because as I think you've argued, for many, wealth or material well-being isn't enough to appease the anger that you sometimes hear expressed by Palestinians about the situation. So I'm asking for if you have how would you argue to someone like that who actually wants the destruction of the Israeli state or would rather have not a a Jewish state, a binational state or something along that lines.
I think I did provide a moral basis in my conclusion when I said that the Palestinians would be better off, that if they can be convinced to give up their goal of eliminating Israel, they will then be in a position to build, to tend to their own garden, and to improve their own lives. I don't think that's an argument that can be made to them, to say, look, Palestinians, stop this, and look how much better your lives will be. But I do think it is a moral argument that I can make to you and say it is reason for us to support the Israelis to go through and take the steps that are necessary to force the Palestinians to the bitter crucible of coming out of the experience and concluding that they cannot go on. And I might add that my own understanding of this is colored by my own experience in having lived through the only defeat the United States has endured. We lost in 1975 in Vietnam, not because we had a smaller army or a smaller arsenal or a smaller economy or a smaller population, but because we had a smaller will. It's will it's about. And the goal here, and my goal here, is to get the Palestinian will to be reduced, not to have this determination to go on. I don't think they're supermen and superwomen. I think that can happen. And I think the moral argument is quite clear. They will be better off for it. This is not looking to destroy the Palestinians. This is looking to liberate the Palestinians.
So I think that what I would say, and again, I guess I'm colored by my experiences as well, that I spent many years living there and interviewing people from all different sides, not just meaning Palestinians or Israelis, but there is a huge diversity of opinion among Israelis and also among Palestinians. And you often see, you know, I would argue that even though Hamas is saying something, you know, that they have in their charter and their politics, I would argue that there are probably quiet talks between Israeli officials and Hamas officials over not necessarily a peace agreement or even any kind of agreement, but of a practical nature. The Israelis want to get Gilad Shavit back. You know, they're obviously talking to someone about that. And who are they going to talk to? I mean, so what I found is, although there are people who obviously have strong ideologies, beneath all of that, when you're going into people's homes, when you're going to the universities, when you're talking to the editors and the writers, there's a lot of stuff going on that we don't even necessarily hear about, and that I think opinions are much more fluid and that there's much more room for small compromises, even small incremental steps, before we even have to get to some big, you know, overarching resolution. And what we, I think, miss here by not living there is when you actually talk to the people who are having to deal with all the consequences of what happens in the street, opinions shift and they cross boundaries. And, you know, you might vote Likud in one election, but come up with some opinion on some issue that might dovetail more with the Labor Party. Just as here, you may vote Republican, but on certain issues you find yourself, you know, aligned with the Democrats. So I guess what I would say to the people here is to keep in mind also the fluidity and the fact that it's not either or, and that people living there don't see it always as an either or situation, and they're willing to talk on one thing and not on another and compromise on one thing. And the goal should be to try to find more issues and topics around which you could get some conversation going.
If there is, Amy, this great diversity of opinion among Palestinians as there is among Israelis, I wonder, I'll put it to both of you, are Palestinians, do they feel as free to express that diversity of opinion? And if the answer to that, as I suspect, might be no, what practical steps could be taken by any party to try to increase their safety and security in expressing diverse opinions?
I think it is very hard to, you know, express diverse opinions, and not even because of the fear, let's say, of an extreme repercussion that, you know, you might anger an authority who throws you in jail, or even worse, you might anger someone who's not an authority but has a gun. I mean, I think that that's always a danger for, and it can be a danger in many places. But I would also say that even among Israelis, I mean, it's a very, yes, people feel free to express, but also many of us feel loyalty to our tribes. I mean, I always found it amazing as a journalist coming in as an American representing the Wall Street Journal, the first question I was always asked, and not only by Palestinians, also by Israelis, are you a Jew? Are you a Christian? What are you? And, you know, I used to try to avoid giving the answer because I thought, why is this even relevant? I would say, I'm an American. I'm a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. What more do you need to know? But they really did want to know more. They were quite insistent on asking me, because once you answer their question, they go and make assumptions about what you might be thinking. You know, as for trying to bolster, you know, people who might want to talk, I think it's easier to talk when you're not in your home situation. You're not having to go home to your neighbors who are going to say, hey, I saw you talking with that Israeli. What do you mean talking to that Palestinian? What are you doing? You know, there was just a bombing. How could you even, you know, talk with someone? They're all like this. They're all like that. You hear that all the time. You know, I would like to see us inviting people to come here, even just to talk. Not necessarily, I'm not even talking in a formal way. I'm talking about inviting academics, you know, creative people, artists, just even trying to have a quieter space where you don't have to answer all the time to your neighbor. I mean, I'm not saying that's going to lead to anything dramatic, but I think we're looking for small incremental steps at this point.
Are there ways, Daniel, to minimize intimidation that might be felt on the Arab side of the divide?
No.
Okay. Likely to be the shortest answer or question of the evening. Yes, sir, go ahead.
Hi. I'm struck by what you refer to as this dynamic between the ideal. I'm struck by what you refer to as this dynamic between the ideal and failure, or the ideal and reality. As an African American, I see that same dynamic that exists here in America with regard to race relations. With the ideal being embodied by Barack Obama and his message of hope and unity, which I feel is belied by the reality of inequality and nihilism that is pervasive in much of urban America. And so, it hasn't reached the point of a war of nationalism as it is in the Arab-Israeli conflict, but I feel that it's kind of the ideal kind of frustrates the reality of progress, because I think there are so many people who are entrenched in the status quo. I'm talking about African Americans who, for example, are, you know, just tied to their lifestyle, standard of living, and, you know, which is really beyond the reach of the masses. And so I'm curious as to what degree you feel that ideal is really frustrating the progress of a real progress in the Arab-Israeli conflict, and if in fact it is frustrating that. I apologize, I came a little late, so if you've already answered that, please accept my apology.
To what extent is the ideal frustrating progress in the Arab-Israeli conflict? Well, I do think that coming back to negotiations between enemy parties over and over again, I read you a list of some dozen attempts, is a form of misplaced idealism. It's not taking into account the realities. I tried to document for you briefly the counterproductivity of specifically the Oslo 7 years, and yet it doesn't seem to make any difference. Every politician, practically every politician anyway, comes to the table with that same goal, including John McCain yesterday. I think that it is, they are in the grip of a hope, and it's a hope that has proven illusional until now, and I believe will continue to remain illusional until the premises are changed and until the Palestinians give up the hope of eliminating Israel. So it's abiding, it's lasting, it continues to be powerful. There are, I think, more skeptics and opponents to this today than there were 15 years ago, but we are still in the minority.
Dr. Pipes suggested that we should try to change the vision for about 40% of the Palestinians. I wonder if both of you could give us some suggestions how we might try to do that.
How to convince 40% of the Palestinians that they should give up on the effort to eliminate Israel? Well, I have rather intentionally not gone into how to implement this, because I think the important thing is to provide an alternative to the current policy. Current policy is one of resolution, diplomacy, negotiations, and I'm saying that's wrong. But I can't really provide for you now what all the alternative would be, what the alternative would be in detail. I can point to a couple of things. I can say, for example, that I think it would be smart if we, instead of having this unclear policy on Jerusalem, where we don't recognize Jerusalem as the Israeli capital, we don't have our embassy there, but we do, in other ways, de facto accept that's the capital of Israel. I think we should come out very clearly and say Israel is the capital of Israel. Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. I think it would be a real step forward in making it clear that Israel's there, it's permanent, Jerusalem is its capital, and end this nonsense about playing games on Jerusalem. Another area I think is extremely important are the so-called Palestinian refugees. It's a long, complex story, but in very brief, there's one definition for refugee that applies to the entire world except Palestinians, and that in brief says that the person who flees is the refugee. And in the case of the Palestinian, is the person who flees plus the descendants. So if one takes the high number of 700,000 Palestinians who fled in 1948-49, if one used the universal definition, that number would be down to what, 70,000, 50,000, 80,000? And decreasing by the day. 60 years ago, people are getting old. But if one uses the special Palestinian definition, then the numbers are growing. And if you add in that a Palestinian and non-Palestinian have a child, that is a Palestinian child, well, you're now 6 million, it's going to go to 10 million, 20 million. And that's a bureaucratic fact. It's a definition in the United Nations, and we abide by it, and we endorse it, and we pay for the implications of it. We shouldn't be doing that. So we should look much more deeply at these kind of questions and figure out what we can do that's useful, for example, Jerusalem or the refugees or many, many other things.
I think I'd like to also add that I personally am extremely skeptical about using numbers like 40% of a population, we need to persuade them not to want to exterminate the state of Israel. I think polling is notoriously unreliable. You can just even look at exit polls for Clinton versus Obama, where they were predicting one or the other was going to win. It's
I think it's very hard for me to even accept the premise that there's a definitive X percent, you know, of Palestinians that want to see the state of Israel, you know, wiped off the face of the earth. I also want to just, the word hope, we keep sort of using it and almost making fun of it. And I guess I want to provide sort of the counter argument, which is, you can be a realist. You can say that this isn't going to be solved in a short term. This is going to be painful. This is going to cause who knows what, and still have hope. Because I think that, when you speak with Israeli military officials, and they're very open in giving their views to the Israeli press, I mean, you can read articles in the major Israeli newspapers where they talk about it. Israeli military officials will say, point blank, this military solution is not the solution. That is, we are strong and we will be able to defend the state of Israel. We're not going to go under from this. You know, it's horrible that it's being inflicted on us. Innocent people are being killed. But this isn't going to lead to the destruction of the state of Israel. We can fight back and no one's going to be pushing us into the sea. So they say all the time, but that's not going to solve the broader problem. We, the military people, are not going to be able to do that. You're going to have to come up with some kind of political strategy. What that strategy is, of course, they're still working out, and they're also stymied in Israel by the fact that they have a very weak prime minister, very weak. So, I mean, I think that we're going to have to wait and see, but I wouldn't say that we necessarily either have to lose hope or even that we can do smaller steps to bolster people that down the road, as you keep up the military kind of answering immediate existential threats, continuing to at least look for openings and even to bolster them. You know, I guess maybe because I have young children, I refuse to give up on the idea that sometime that it could improve.
Well, let me concur that it can improve. I'm just saying it has to be done via war as opposed to finessing and compromising and negotiating. But I have hope too.
Does it, in your views, does it help matters or hinder matters when presidential candidates in this country say a priori that they will be powerfully committed to the peace process and the peace process must go forward? To bring it to the topic of the night, does it help or does it hurt when candidates for president of the United States put so much emphasis on that abstract idea that the peace process must be pursued?
Well, you have to take into account that John McCain is running for office, and his visit was for the American audience, not for the Israeli audience or the Palestinian audience. So, personally, until he's elected president, or if he's elected president, you know, I think that his visit there has nothing to do with American policy and everything to do with trying to win an American election. An actual president of the United States, you know, I think that they do have to decide what their strategy is going to be in the Middle East. I don't think you can ignore it, obviously. So, but I wouldn't listen to what a presidential candidate says necessarily as being policy-oriented. I think it's, you know, trying to win votes.
I regret that John McCain came out for what I call the war process, and that's one reason why I supported Rudy Giuliani, because he was the one candidate who said, well, he wasn't the only one, Mike Huckabee too, but Rudy Giuliani said, I disagree with this approach, and I will approach it in a quite different way. So I regret that McCain is subscribing to a failed approach.
I think we have time for one last one, and sir, you get it.
There is one thing I cannot comprehend. When Israel is being bombarded by the rockets, by Qassam rockets, and in exchange, they are supplying to their enemies. They are supplying fuel and food and medications and everything. It's beyond any reasonable logic. You're feeding, helping your enemy. How do you explain this?
How does one explain that the Israelis are providing the fuel and other components for the bombs, the rockets that the Gazans are sending against Israel? How does one explain that the Israelis are simply passive as these rockets descend on Sderot month after month, in a sense waiting for them to fall in a kindergarten and kill 20 children and then have a crisis? I can only refer to what Ms. Marcus called a very weak prime minister. I'd add that in addition to being very weak, he has no vision and no understanding and is simply trying to hold on and keep the reins of power, and to do something about this problem might jeopardize his coalition and he might be out of office.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking both of our speakers tonight.